Okay, we have a quorum, you can leave. Are you?
Do come back.
I'm coming back.
Okay, why don't we take up Senate Bill 206 first? Try to get it out of the way. Did you want to testify on it again, or just watch us do the dirty deed, or what?
Right, well, as you're aware, we're certainly still opposed to the idea. And one of the things in going over the draft for the committee substitute that you have proposed, it would appear that any reference to the period of time during which we've had registration closed, which was that period basically 30 days prior to the election, has come out with this draft of the bill. So there's now no reference to the system or to voter registration being closed at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I assume that.
So perhaps I had misunderstood.
No, the intent was to shut it down for the 30 days, but still to allow registration on election day.
However, I think with the way this is drafted, that that has come out completely.
Yeah, we can.
I think it's important to leave that 30-day in there, even though we allow it. Because otherwise, there goes our leg for keeping
that.
This way, you're going to have one day wonders.
Right.
Well, not if they have adequate proof of residency.
Yeah, they'd have to have proof
of residency.
You
know, Mr. Chairman, I wasn't here when we testified. I'm very tired of this. But I lived through the days of here when we didn't have any registration. Don't tell me today there wasn't a lot of double, triple, quadruple voting going on, because I know there was. And what you're going to have, I'll for instance take this time, a tremendous number of bond issues on. And somebody that doesn't care is going to live up here anyway. And you know we've got a lot of people in the state, certainly aren't residents, and no plan on being residents, but we'll go in some resident and vote. And they'll vote for every one of them, and then we're here to carry the load. Now, I'm not saying that they're good or bad. I personally think we're putting too many of them up. That's beside the point. And I think some of them are very, very needed. But I think we've defeated registration.
That was what we testified to when we were here previously. And another thought that has come up in the meantime that I'd like to pass on is, for instance, this would relate to city and borough elections too. So if there was, you know, for instance, in relation to their bond propositions and things, this would of course hold true on those too, not only with our state bond propositions.
More than the state.
Right.
Yeah. Well, this bill wouldn't eliminate the residency requirement.
Well, you can see it doesn't. Don't tell me that doesn't. These words in there. Part of time avoided. Sure does.
If you're not registered, you don't have a little card to show that you're registered, your thing is going to be placed in a contested ballot envelope.
Yeah, but it says right here, it's registered before the election or at the time of voting. Yeah,
right, however.
But the criteria is still the same. You still have to be here for 30 days.
And there's a much, on election day, there's a much stricter requirement.
Tell me how you can prove or disprove that.
Your driver's license.
You don't have to have a driver's license here. I haven't even got a driver's license.
Then you probably wouldn't be allowed to vote.
I just forgot to get it, and I just decided.
You probably wouldn't be allowed to vote on election day then.
I'm bored.
The way the thing reads is you have to show a driver's license that was at least 30 days old in order to be allowed to register and vote on election
day. Well, I'm not going to win on this anyway, but I just had
it. It seems to me anyway that a 30-day-old driver's license would be adequate proof that you'd been in.
It doesn't
state
mean that he's going to be an Alaskan resident, believe me. Look at your pipeline work. And I'll bet next fall, every blasted one of them will get out. They'll get out and vote. Because they all have voting booths in the camps up.
We won't know. It will be by absentee voting in the camps, as we have done in prior years. And we found out from experience from having, you know, for instance, election supervisors travel in the camp areas whenever they approach them about registering to vote. And of course, since we do have the cancellation card, and you know, if they indicate some interest in registering to vote, we indicate to them that we're going to cancel their voter registration wherever they came from. And that cuts many of them off cold right there, because they don't want to cancel their voter registration wherever they came from. So then if they don't want to fill out that cancellation card, they don't fill out the form to register.
The thing is, Helen, right
can
now...
can they have that at the polls at the time that they vote, say, or at the time of voting? Would they then have it at the polls, too?
They would have it at the polls, yes.
Well,
you know, by the same token, if somebody had gone ahead and requested a ballot from their, wherever they might be registered, they could certainly have cast that absentee ballot, and we wouldn't get that cancellation card back, you know, until well after the other state may have already counted the ballot.
Thing is, Helen, the state already makes every effort it can to register pipeline workers. We send registration teams to various camps. Certainly, I don't think it's going to make it, you know, any easier for pipeline workers as opposed to anybody else.
In fact, in the last election, the pipeline workers were supposed to have saved our candidate. And
Because the average pipeline worker won't be able to take advantage of this law, because he's not, he won't be at a location where there's a precinct polling place.
I really need to just pick the pipeline worker. But we have a lot of canceled people up here. They'll register if they can register on the day. They'll vote any place they want.
And so they won't be able to vote in more than one place. First of all, if they vote in 10 places, at each and every place they'll have to present positive proof of identification. Their vote will be held aside, and if it turns out they have voted in 10 places, the votes won't be counted, for one thing, and secondly, they will have committed a felony.
Well, I didn't mean in Alaska, but I mean
Under the present system, there's nothing to stop somebody from registering under 10 different names in 10 different places, showing up on election day and voting without once ever having to prove his identity. Whereas under this law, if he does intend to vote on election day, there'll be, you know, positive proof of identity. Somebody wants to go to the problem of coming out with 10 different fake driver's licenses to vote in 10 different places, you could probably do it.
Where is the driver's license?
Page 2, line 11.
Or other documents. Because I was just saying, there are a lot of people that don't have.
Well, by regulation, that can be taken care of, but I doubt if the elections office would accept anything less than something as positive as a...
We had in mind, you know, of course, the driver's license, rent receipts, utility bills, things along those lines. Whenever we
for proof of
this.
Residency, but in terms of identification, what would you accept?
Okay, let's see. In order for a person to get his driver's license up here, does he not have to have a birth certificate?
Oh, I mean, the law on its face accepts a 30-day-old driver's license as proof of both identification and residency. Now, you were saying rent receipts and utilities. Let's say if a guy comes in with less than a 30-day-old driver's license, he'd also have to have, you know, rent receipts and utilities. But if he doesn't have a driver's license at all, Do you have it? Is there anything you'd accept as proof of identity?
Let's see, what could we accept?
Well, I'm not saying you have to accept anything, but, you know, if you decide that driver's license is the only valid proof, then you probably wouldn't have to accept anything.
Well, for identification, birth certificate. And that wouldn't have anything to do with the residency, but it'd be sure who you were. No, you have to do something. Well, you show your receipts and stuff like that for residency. Draft card.
Receipts. Well, I mean, it happens that you have to do something for the hospital. I mean,
yes.
Showing that you, like a tax bill.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, the whole intent is to make it simply easier for people to vote, which. Originally was the intent of voter registration laws. Is there anything else in the bill other than the whole, you know, philosophical objection to it? Specific things?
Yes, there are a number of things. On line 13 and 14, or generally that whole section, the address of a voter as it appears on his official voter registration, rather than card, we would like to say record. For instance, if a person may have several voter acknowledgement cards as such, with a varying assortment of addresses, but as the records is indicated in the election supervisor's office, would be, we think, much more appropriate. On line 15, perhaps if we could delete beginning with the second word, if the person, down through however, of the new underlining, so that the address as it appears on his official voter registration record is presumptive evidence of the person's voting residence, upon furnishing in writing or otherwise evidence of change of address, etc. We think that would be better wording on that. On page 2, line 7. Now I'm assuming that perhaps the wording that is being deleted there will probably go back in. So
yes.
That we do have a 30-day close.
Yes.
If we could have accept that no registration will be effective for a period of 30 days preceding the election. Our thoughts of that are that as such, we don't always close registration because there's always another election coming up, so that if we can set those aside and go ahead and register and fill out the forms, if we can set them aside and then process them after that particular election. There might be a better word than effective, but that was one that we came up with. The same thing down on line 18.
Well, that entire section would, well, I was going to say would probably be deleted, but if you wanted...
We think it would be better if it
were
reworded.
To just make that, yeah. Okay.
With the addition of the word effective for made. Again, down on line 28 on the second page, that wording, that may have to be changed a little bit further, though. The request shall be effective at least 30 days before the election day.
On that, and where do you move within that 30 days?
Basically, we do not process anything that occurs within that 30-day closure period until after the election. Those are considered as being valid for the succeeding election, not for that election. So we simply take them and set them aside.
Well, where do you want that? this could well happen to me this year, in the cell 1 house. And it might be right in, within 30 days.
Go to the old.
Technically, no, now you must go to your new precinct to vote. We did that in 75.
Move in 30 days.
If you move, you go to your new precinct to vote.
And then you do, Rich.
You vote a question ballot.
But you do, it gets counted then, as soon as it's ascertained.
As long as the person is this, within that same district, yes.
No, that's a regulation.
No, it's in the statute.
Same district?
As long as it's within the same district.
Well, in her case, it's not. She's changing the election district.
Changing election district. If I move to the old house.
Okay, you.
She's moving from turning into downtown.
Mm-hmm.
She makes the change within the 30-day period. Where does she go to vote on election?
Okay, if she would not, if she's moving from election district to election district, she basically, since it's within that 30-day closure, according to this law that we enacted last year, she should go to her new precinct and vote.
She won't be there 30 days, she'll
vote absentee. Vote absentee. Because you're not.
She votes absentee. She votes in the precinct or district in which she currently lives.
Yeah, because she would. Right, she would not have established residency, 30-day residency. I'm assuming that's a different election district.
Yes.
Okay, would not have established residence within that election district. So you would need to vote absentee to make sure that you get the proper ballot.
But you can't vote absentee this day of the election.
Yes, you can.
How long before an election can you get your absentee? You can't vote absentee.
Day before.
Oh, you've got me all confused now. Which election district would I get the absentee ballot for?
For the house with your old residence, your old house, or the house you're moving from.
Then the law isn't holding up. They say you vote in your new district.
But you have not established residence in your new district yet. With your 30-day residence.
I guess I won't be able to sell until after the election.
Sounds good.
Well, within Anchorage, you might have all the other districts' ballots that she could cast an absentee ballot.
Yes.
But what if you move from Anchorage to Yakutat? You're all 30-day Alaskan.
But you're not a 30-day resident of that election district.
Yeah, well, that's what I mean. But people at Yakutat aren't going to have an Anchorage ballot available for you to vote absentee.
No. It would require an absentee ballot to do it.
That's an absentee ballot requested in advance.
Right. Because one of the qualifications for voting is that you must be a 30-day resident of the election district. So if you move from one.
How does that dovetail with the new law that says you vote in a new precinct?
Well,
if you change districts.
That is for those people who have actually their 30-day residence and who neglected to change their address. So we want to catch them and get those addresses changed and get them correct.
We passed that law, didn't we?
Yeah, we did, as a matter of fact. However, perhaps might be a chance to go back and look at that, because we said that they must vote in their new election or in their new precinct. All right, that's wiped out, for instance, those people who might be all of a sudden called out of the town or on the way to the airport, think, oh, geez, I forgot to vote. So they whip into their nearest precinct to vote. The way we have that law written now, we think that's illegal. So I think we need to look at that and do something about it.
Couldn't we put it right in this?
It was last year. But
who's chairman last year?
But I'll get the specific statute reference on that. But I think there really is a problem with that.
Well, the committee's in more competent hands this year, so we'll take care of it.
I think there is a real problem. I should think, you know, that it must be back to their.
There'll have to be a redraft on this anyway. Could you try to come up with some proposed language for it?
Yes, I will.
I can feel a little bit of that.
There's be something in it for you.
Well, there already is something in it we like. That's about changing addresses without a written affidavit, so that, for instance, we could get this information over the telephone by getting the person's, for instance, his voter number, social security number, birth date, etc., things that we can match up to what we have on file over the phone.
Do you have any other suggested changes?
No, I think those are the ones that we had in mind.
Okay, so then we'll just sort of hang on to this till you can come up with some language for that other part.
Okay, I'll do that.
Okay, thanks for coming by.
Thanks.
Let's take 698 next.
Submitting a revised version here, a minor revision, that as we staffed this in our department, we looked at a few word changes. Now, this revision has been staffed with the Attorney General's office and with the Governor's office, and it's a change of a minor change in wording that brings about the original intent that we wanted to go. Yes, ma'am. There should be one attached. I have some here. One here.
Did
you have
I'll have him.
Copies of this?
Yeah, I know. And
oh, you got
I'll use the sign.
Right.
Because it's got the attachment to it, but both pages.
What an inside deal is.
Right.
Even if everyone on this phone and everything you would get, we wouldn't use this.
It's a pleasure to appear before the committee again and talk about the. This is a third of the retention incentive measures that we previously testified on, the reenlistment bonus and the educational assistance. This is the roundout one, the third of the package that needs an update. We have, under our present statute, a law that is implemented now providing retirement for service to the Alaska National Guard by our membership, and it, through experience in the last 3 to 4 years, has proven to be unwieldy in its administration and its effects, and we are submitting this change to accomplish a smoother operation of the program. Would you like me to go over the provisions?
Yeah, just the main points. So.
Okay. If I may use a chalkboard. It only takes a few moments of your time, but it is a little bit detailed in the fact that what we have is a...
Where'd you get that chalkboard? That's quite a period piece.
It is. It came from the door.
Oh, we thought you brought it along.
Gathered that.
I had Kathy Hathaway really got it for us. Over here.
It is. William Jennings Bryan wrote it.
I wonder what
she found. I don't know where she found it.
Do you feel historical as you say?
I sure do.
Boy, they
refinished
that.
Uh-huh. It's nice.
Yeah, it is nice, isn't it? Uh-huh. Under our current law, we're provided for a $50 a month retirement pension or retirement pay for the exact number of months the person served in the
Alaska National Guard over 20 years. And upon reaching age 55, $50 a month for the same number of months that the person is a member of the Alaska National Guard.
Well, wait a minute now. This is the start. If a member, say,
10 years.
10 years, how much would they get?
They would get $50 a month for 120 months. At age 55. Now, the difficulties with our present program is the fact that the way the law reads and the way it came out, and it was Attorney General's opinion, too, that the person must be a member in uniform at age 55. He must be an active member at age 55, which means he can join at age 20 and have to spend 35 years in the Alaska National Guard and live in a uniform that long, and at 55 then retire. That's
get $50 a month?
They would get $50 a month for 35 years.
That's too much to ask of anybody living in a uniform at home.
That's right. That's right.
Especially if we only got one uniform.
Which some of our people do have. But the problem is, there is an alternative that, or upon involuntary retirement because of not being able to meet federal physical standards. And that is the present experience factor has most of the people at that age level take a physical and they don't pass the physical. So then they can draw their $50 a month retirement upon their retirement, you see. But it's difficult to, it's not saying that that the man has to go through this effort right here in order to be eligible for the retirement by age 55. And what our proposal attempts to do is to provide for $50 a month retirement for the number of months that the person was a member, qualifying. And then there's two terms that I'd like to use. There's eligibility and actual pay. Our proposal continues the actual pay at age 55. However, eligibility can occur at the end of 20 years service, total service. Now this means that As if you recall from previous testimony, we have all sorts of combinations of people in the Guard. We have 10-year active duty veterans, 12-year active duty veterans, 2-year active duty veterans, and 20-year veterans of just straight Alaska National Guard experience. So we are attempting here to combine and to align ourselves with the federal retirement program, which is 20 years of service, you see. However, paying only that amount of time that the individual was a member of the Alaska National Guard. So let us say that we have a man who's age 20 and he spends 10 years in active duty. And then he breaks from active duty and he spends 10 years in the Alaska National Guard. Under our current program, the way this reads, at 20 years of service, he'd have to spend another 20 years to be eligible for Alaska National Guard retirement pay, because he'd have to devote a total of 20 years to the Alaska National Guard and be at age 55. What we want to say with our program is, yes, you can retire here, and in the future, at age 55, you will receive 10 years worth of retirement, the same number of months that you serve the Alaska National Guard. But to give eligibility credit for the other 10 years of active duty. Because under the federal system, this man can retire at the end of his 20th year reserve service and draw deferred retirement too, you see, under the federal system. Now, we, as you know, we are both federal and state combined here, and we serve two bosses, the commander-in-chief, the governor, and then upon mobilization, the president. So we're not really doing dual compensation for the same service.
Excuse me. Now, the active duty, is active duty in the Guard or active
No,
duty?
Ma'am. I mean the active duty at Fort Richardson, let's say, or at Elmendorf.
And that man isn't being able to collect twice on that active duty. The only thing that active duty is help his eligibility, am I right?
That's correct. That's correct. We're not dual paying, but a man who, if we just have a qualifier 20 years in the Alaska National Guard, it's foreseeable, the guy will have 40 years service, not 40, 39, because we can't take a 20-year retiree off of active duty. But he joins at 20. It's not logical to ask the man to spend another 10 years in the Alaska National Guard to be eligible for his retirement. We want to have a concurrent retirement program here, but paying only from the state that which was his service to the state.
And not
for the...
Not for
he'll receive federal
compensation
for
double.
That. Right. And this will not, this only includes the Alaska National Guard, not California National Guard, nor any U.S. Army or Air Force Reserve Service or anything like that. Just our own local people.
Do I understand that the Alaska National Guard time will also make him eligible for the federal time, too?
Oh, yes. That's correct.
That's already the law.
That's already cranked in the federal system, and that's why they can retire at age, after 20 years of service. Drawing deferred payment.
Mm-hmm.
We don't get it
until
they're right. 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 Until they're age 60 in the federal system. This is, a realignment of some very critical experience factors in our program. It does not cost any more than what it would cost this way. You see, because we're talking about the same number of eligible. It would advance their time to make a few more eligible sooner under this provision. Make that clear. Instead of having to be at age 55, the eligible would be eligible at the completion of their 20 years and then would draw pay at age 55. Yeah, so it wouldn't have any measure, it wouldn't have any bearing on that. The age limit, age 55, would be the same under 51. It would make it easier for them to become eligible for it.
Can I have just a second? Can I ask you something? With this new bill, we already have that current program, and we've got 76 years.
74.
All right, does that include the current program?
Yes.
Then there's I have to make a new fiscal note. Did you? Same thing as
no, this
on
is the
other
impact.
One.
Right now?
Do you see what I mean? Is that additional? Is what I'm asking you.
Once we've established a quorum.
It's 50,000 is our current program.
And so additional
is
24?
24,000, right.
Okay, I have to.
We did it again.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, okay.
This fiscal note was made at the same time as another one. I'd like to revise that fiscal note if I could for you. If you will notice the first page on the 74,000 on 1976, current law we now have on the books for $50,000 approximately. So I put the total cost of the program in there instead of the impact, which would be only about $24,000 additional. So I'll have that over to you today.
Okay.
Okay?
Excuse me.
Don't forget to make that call.
No, I'm going to try to hit this 15 minutes before I get
in here. Are there any other questions? Okay, I'll just pass it around. You can find it out.
We certainly thank you very much for the help that you've given us on this program.
You've got a real cell job on your hands. Yeah.
This is a good news, bad news joke.
Is this the employment one?
This is the good news part.
Are you talking about?
No, it goes to finance next.
Oh, okay. I thought you were talking the other one we had in your committee.
All the time, the good news is the best state of affairs. The bad news is.
Right. Well, we'll get that fiscal note changed and it won't look quite so bad, huh?
Okay, yeah.
I've got current law right difference. In there.
I believe, I don't know whether any of the representatives here are on the finance committee, but we, for your information, we did have a due pass on the reenlistment bonus and the educational assistance out of the House Finance Committee.
They're in rules now.
Presently in rules
waiting
committee.
For them to go on the calendar. Well, you know, I called over there today.
Is that right?
Terrible.
I know.
Do you have a lot of bills in there? Is there something holding those up?
He's the
rules
chairman.
Yeah, I know. Yeah.
You'll be all right in rules.
They're in there now, yeah.
You also have a bill, a Senate bill, in this committee.
Really?
That came through the Senate relating to unemployment compensation, which I was going to offer, if the committee has had a moment, a brief summary of, so that if it comes up at a time when we're up in Anchorage and you want to talk about it real quick, you might not need to have testimony or at the convenience of the committee. Is what I'm
okay, why don't you give us a quick run through on
basically it's Senate Bill 495, and what it does, it accepts drill pay, weekend drill pay, from the definition of employment for unemployment compensation. There are 18 classifications of exceptions to employment, including regular active service retired pay. In other words, a fellow spends 20 years, he gets 50% of his pay, he lives in Alaska, he draws unemployment, let's say, doesn't have a job. That his retirement pay is excluded from the definition of employment, you know, so that he doesn't, it's not, his unemployment is not reduced. We propose to make the Alaska National Guard drill pay only, not the annual training pay, but the drill pay, excluded from unemployment compensation computations, too. And it's a very simple bill, and it's a minor thing. In regards to units, it's one of those sandpaper things for the small percentage of people that are drawing unemployment to voluntarily perform services in the Alaska National Guard.
And what is drill pay a month for that?
For a private E-2, it's about $48 for the weekend. Between $50 and $100 we normally figure.
You're losing me though. What's the effect? What does it do?
It reduces his retirement pay. He's got a. It reduces his unemployment compensation pay.
The guardsman is out of work too. They don't subtract what he got from the guard.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, right. Okay. It's a weekend type work. It's patriotic, voluntary. Yeah. You know, et cetera, et cetera. You know, yeah.
That's not very much money.
Behind the board, I have a flag. But I thought I could possibly. Save a testimony here.
I'm not sure if just a lot of maybe
chatting about.
Set a hearing for
this.
That's real very question for the governor. The fiscal note seems to.
Fiscal note of $206,000.
On that, yes, sir. Right. On the unemployment compensation.
Okay, well.
Well, that was computed at a maximum computation when we figured 260 persons who are participating, 10% of our strength participating in the unemployment. And then a statewide average of $76 a week makes a gross total of $1 million. And then we estimated only 20% of that total has been excluded from payment to recipients who are part-time members. So in other words, the state of Alaska would pay $206,000 more in unemployment compensation by exempting National Guard pay from consideration for the 260 participants.
We'll set a hearing for it. I wouldn't want to
yes, sir.
Pass
I
it out without
that.
Taking testimony
right.
from
yes,
the Department of Labor on it.
Sure. Right.
That might be a high estimate, and it might be that a lot of people don't claim, maybe a lot of the Eskimo or Natives don't claim this, too, and be just the honest people that get hurt often.
We tested.
Of course, to
trade, and the Eskimos would be less honest.
We presented our a detailed analysis to the Senate Labor and Management Committee on the program and on the unemployment compensation. And I hope the committee understands I was not trying to jump the gun or anything. I thought I'd just chat about it while I'm down here and in front of the committee and possibly save either a trip or...
Okay, we'll set a hearing on it.
Thank you very much, sir.
Department of Labor and your department in on it.
If possibly on the next time, if there's no other hearings, possibly Kathy could come up and represent the department as we've chatted here. And then this trying to really save the state some money in the yes, sir. Really.
Yeah,
my own travel, but
you
can.
You could have gone all day without saying.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Okay, we'll just take 477 now. All right. Do all of you want to testify on this, or just Okay. Well, why don't you go ahead and.
I'm primarily interested in line 23 of 477, which covers the Corps of Engineers. It's a security guard.
You know, I'm probably the only one here who doesn't know who we are.
Bob Brandt, excuse me.
Bob Brandt.
Excuse me. The reason I'm interested in that, I also had approximately 2.5 years with the United States Marshal as a Deputy United States Marshal in Anchorage way back in 1941-42. And I thought I'd be covered in that. However, my record is not included in Colorado in the government, U.S. government records. Why, I don't know. But I have all kinds of evidence, records showing that I was a Deputy United States Marshal down at the Whittier when they put the tunnel through over to Portage. And the retirement office will not accept my affidavits and everything I have as a Deputy United States Marshal. So they suggested that I put in as a security guard with the Corps of Engineers during that time. After that, I went with the territory and with the territorial police and state police, which is with the state and territory for 27 plus years.
Are there any questions?
Did your situation in Bob need a change in that language?
Pardon?
Does this, where it says U.S. Army Corps of Engineers security guards, does that cover you then? For the
yes,
time?
It would. It would, definitely would.
Okay, so you're just testifying in favor of the bill.
Yeah, the federal records show me as a security guard with the Corps of Engineers.
Now that covers the time for the Whittier Tunnel and all that?
Right, okay. That is right. Right.
Was it with statehood that you transferred over into the state?
Pardon?
Was it with statehood you transferred over to the state? When we got statehood in 1959, was that when you went to work for the state?
Right.
Yeah.
Oh, no. No, I went with the state and, or with the state, right, yeah. You are. Right. It was only a short time with the public safety, and then I went with the public works for the balance of the year until I retired in 1969.
Was that the first job you had that you'd be covered by this? Was that with your tunnel experience and the Anchorage time?
Right.
So you went to work then in police work, and you went all the way through until you retired.
Right. No, I was with the police until statehood, a few months after statehood, and then I went with the public works. But it was with the police, territorial police, and state police, 17 plus years. A superintendent of the territorial police for 6.5 years.
Do I understand, Mr. Radford, as far as you know, you're probably the only person
As far as I know, I am the only one. There was 9 of us come up with the Corps of Engineers security guards and at the beginning of the war at Fort Richardson. And I definitely know that the other eight, they're either dead or they've left the state many years ago. And I am the only one that this would affect, my knowledge. Yeah. Give me approximately 2.5 years on my state retirement now, which I'm sure really after it. I retired, in fact, I retired 6 months too soon when the new retirement system came into effect. It's still going ever since, and I'm sitting there.
Do you want to testify on this bill?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My name is Lieutenant John Monagle. I'm with the Alaska State Troopers. And I've been with the state since territorial days 1957. I have 19 years in with the department. But I also have 5 previous years with the Juneau Police Department, for which, under this bill, I'd be receiving credit. And for that reason, of course, I'm here to speak in favor of the bill. Basically, I see the bill as a very simple one, and one which attempts to do one thing primarily, and that's to obtain credit for those people who otherwise have no means of getting credit for that contiguous service that they started prior to statehood and are continuing now through territorial days and up through statehood at the present time, and such as myself. There were some injustices, I feel, without this bill that were experienced by Superintendent Brandt here, as well as my father, who retired after 21 years of service with the state. And of course, this was prior to this police and fireman bill, but $290-some a month. I think that's ridiculous. And now he would receive 5 or 6 years that credit for police service prior to this time also. And there are others. And it's a small group, but one I think who have proven their dedication to the state, to stay here and to work here and to retire here. These people that, like Superintendent Brandt, aren't going anywhere. They're here, and so I'm very in favor for the bill. I've talked to other police and firemen, of course, in Sitka and Anchorage and here that are obviously in favor of it. The APOA has come out. Alaska Peace Officers in favor of it. The Chiefs Association, the Fire Chiefs Association, has come out in favor of it, and I want to add my support to that.
During my time as territorial police, I hired Lieutenant Monaco.
Best thing you ever did.
Here he is. Yeah. That's
what you hired this fellow.
No.
Do you think?
No.
Sure.
Let me just ask you a question, because it's been asked to me, and I haven't known how to answer it, so maybe you can give me a hint. I've already been approached by other people who work for municipalities and say, hey, if you're going to bring the territorial police who work for municipalities prior to statehood, how come we clerks and assessors and all the other people that work for the municipalities aren't similarly being covered under this? I didn't have an answer.
Well,
maybe.
Well, I have no rebuttal either. If they can show, if you feel that they ought to receive credit for that, that's fine. You know, but I think that when you're talking about police and firemen and security guards and those kinds of people, I think you're talking about an entirely different ballgame. I feel the police, frankly, and specifically the territorial and now state police, are head and shoulders above most government services. They put in long hours, irregular hours. Their families put up with a lot of stuff that the clerks who work an 8-to-5 job don't, and I don't think there's any reason why they should be put in the same classification.
Any more questions?
Yeah,
Are you going to testify?
Sure. I'm Lieutenant Fanning, Alaska State Firefighters Association. I would just like to say that the Alaska State Firefighters Association are also in favor of this bill. It does cover some of our people, and I think it would be really a great justice to have this for them.
Mr. Gates is here, I assume. There wasn't one attached to the bill. I don't understand how it made it by the Senate without a fiscal note.
From Juno?
Yes, sir.
Any other questions?
No, I was kind of curious about this.
Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Mr. Gates?
I've met these gentlemen here. Of course, I know Mike, and I haven't met you.
I'm Bill Parker.
Oh, yeah. You're Mr. Parker. Yeah. Thank you. Nice meeting you, gentlemen.
Thank you. Can we feel assured it'll go on through them?
You can stick around and hear the other.
We have some more testimony in the bill.
Good.
See you again.
Nice to see you, gentlemen.
Without us,
huh? We were close and missed. Mr. Chairman, I just was giving your assistant a copy of the fiscal note. There was one that was sent over several days ago on the bill, and apparently you didn't have one, so they're making a copy at the moment. Oh, here we go.
$7,000?
What?
No. It's administrative cost.
Oh.
The total fiscal note is...
$1,383.
I'm surprised. Yeah, I am too. How many people are in... You estimate that this will...
250 individuals. There's several fiscal notes that have been prepared as the bill has had additional groups of people added to it. And we have testified on a number of occasions on most of these groups individually, and of course it's being combined into a single bill, and you have a fairly sizable group of people with the Alaska Road Commission and Bureau of Public Roads is probably the biggest identifiable group. The next large group, of course, is, and a rather unknown group, by the way, are the policemen and firemen of the territory or a subdivision of the territory. We haven't had an opportunity to testify on that particular group of individuals, but the language, the way it's written, is, I think, could be quite a problem, mainly from the standpoint there's nothing to prevent, for example, any firemen or policemen from the city of Anchorage who are under their own system from retiring from that, coming to work for the state for 3 years, and claiming all their service prior to statehood, and getting dual credit. In other words, credit under our system as well as their own system. So if you'll notice, the language says policeman or fireman of the territory or a political subdivision of the territory. Same thing is true with Ketchikan, which has its own retirement system, and there would be nothing to prevent them likewise from retiring or even not retiring, but just merely coming to work for the state and claiming any service up until the time of statehood. This could be a rather substantial number of individuals. Obviously not terribly substantial, but there's a total of 250, but the amount of service involved and the cost of this legislation would be rather substantial. as shown in the fiscal note.
Mr. Chairman, we already passed out from this committee House Bill 36, which is still in finance, but also House Bill or Senate Bill 222, which is in rules, which only deals with the ARC people.
Correct.
Out of these 250 people that are affected in this bill, how many of those are you figuring are ARC?
Trying to recall right offhand, I'd have, unfortunately, I left my other book there. There were 108 identified individuals within the Department of Highways alone currently working who had former Alaska Road Commission or Bureau of Public Road Service. There were some other individuals scattered around that likewise were working with the state. And if I recall correctly, using non-restrictive language like this has, in other words, not restricting it to only those that are currently working, I believe the number was somewhere around 150 individuals we felt could claim service under that.
And roughly 150 people are the...
I think it was 150 or 160, and then the remainder would be involved with this piece... Well, there's several categories, U.S. Army, Corps of Engineers, security guards, police or firemen of the yeah. territory, somewhere yeah. in the neighborhood of 90 to 100 people.
We heard testimony a few minutes ago before you came in that there's probably only one on the security guard, because there's only nine hired in the first place, apparently, and mm-hmm. he has knowledge that yeah. they're either dead or long gone. Mm-hmm. But there could very well easily be, I imagine, 100 police or firemen. Mm-hmm. So when we say 1,000,003, the new element, police or firemen element, would be, I guess, about two-fifths of that 1,000,003, whatever that would be, probably in the neighborhood of about 700,000.
Let me see if I have the fiscal note on Senate Bill. Senate Bill 222, let's see which version here. We have, which was strictly ARC and BPR. There was a cost there of a little over a half a million. Okay, here we are. The CS for House Bill 36, I believe, is the or Senate Bill 222. Okay. The latest version of 222, there's a problem here because 222 in its final version that went out of the House Finance included some fish and game people too, so I'm trying to back those out. It looks like 0.46 or $832,000. It looks to me as though that was the cost identified for the ARC and BPR with unrestricted language.
So we'd have about 600,000 roughly then with the
With the additional group of the police firemen as well as, how many U.S. Corps of Engineer Guards there are. We found in previous groups when they've been covered, typically the numbers that we've identified at the time of testimony have been somewhat less than what have actually come in and claimed service. So I think it's just a question. A lot of this was some time ago, and individuals get lost or, for one reason or another. So what the actual will be, we feel probably the 250 figure is not out of line in terms of total numbers of bodies. We may be somewhat off in one category or the other. But I think a major problem does exist where we're looking at peace officers and firemen who could well be getting benefits from another system right here within the state, and there's certainly nothing to preclude your older firemen or policemen in municipality of Anchorage, which would be a fairly large group. They have a lot of old-time employees there. They could certainly come to work for the state, and if they work 3 years, they could pick up a second retirement, including all of that service.
How many local retirement systems are there?
There's really only one peace and officer and fireman system, which is the municipality of Anchorage. Then you have a couple other smaller systems, insured systems, like the city of Ketchikan has a separate system for their employees, not only their peace officers and firemen, but all their employees.
An amendment saying that service credit isn't allowed if the period of service is claimed under another retirement system eliminate that problem?
No, because it wouldn't be the same period of service.
Let's say somebody served 5 years for City of Anchorage before statehood. They were claiming that under their policeman and fireman's retirement, putting in a provision that they can't claim it under PERS.
I personally feel that there's a real problem in this area because we've seen how this list has grown since it first started with federal employees. And by going with peace officers and firemen and territorial days, I can foresee where anybody that served as a municipal employee in territorial days, whether or not they were a member of the system, will be requesting similar type of recognition before long. Just as originally, I'm sure, Mike, you recall, it was a relatively small handful of U.S. District Court employees when it started, and it's since then has gone and been extended and extended. And I think that language such as, you know, of the territory, well, any employees of the territory itself are already covered. Because of the way the law reads above, you'll see employee who completes 3 years of service with the state following January 1, '61, for which he makes contributions required, is entitled to service credit for employment rendered to the state in former territory. So to say policemen and firemen of the territory in itself does not add a thing. But where you get is a political subdivision of the territory is really, I think, where the key issue lies. I'm not familiar enough to know how many entities prior to statehood had policemen or firemen. But we do know that virtually no political subdivision that exists today that are members of our system were in prior to the territorial days. We're sure of that. So even what we could be doing by this is where a political subdivision may wish to consider to legitimately cover their prior employees upon return to them, we're actually picking up their liability by doing it in this fashion. Let's take Fairbanks, for example, who is a member of our system, has the right as an employer to recognize former service if they wish, just as we do in this, by taking language like this, if they have not already, which I don't know, they could very well say, well, the state is going to pick up this liability. We won't recognize our prior service. We'll let the state pick it up for us, which could shift the burden of where the liability should be. City of Ketchikan's the same way. They have a system of their own, and if there's certainly no incentive for them to recognize former employment if the law will allow if the state's going to pick it up. So I think you've got the basic problem in saying a political subdivision of the territory. The other is already taken care of.
Well, What do you want to do with them? All right. Let's see. 222 is in rules now?
It's in rules, yeah. So the ARC people are already covered.
Mm-hmm.
In a sense, if we do, we ought to take the ARC out of here because we're just having two bills. All that should do then, too.
Yeah.
You know, there's two ways to look at something like this. One is that as long as the concept seems okay, State Affairs will kick it up to finance, so then worry about the money. The other is to try to do the whole balancing act at this stage. And I, the easy way, of course, is to just pass it on. And I am aiming to take the easy way out.
Well, we were just asking why you were out. The new feature, see, that it's got the ARC feature in which we've already paid. The new feature is considered less, about 600,000. In other words, the
about
well,
five
ARC
two.
Are, well, that's in the other bill.
That's in the other bill.
Bill.
Yeah, I mean, in a sense, I'm just playing with.
Yes, you are.
I'm just kidding myself.
But then again, that's what we do for.
Yeah, that's what. Yes. What else? The new feature on here affects about 100 people.
Is there an official administration position then?
Not really. I think I've expressed the concerns we have with the language, particularly insofar as it applies to political subdivisions of the territory. I think the state is recognizing service that, in most cases, either the political sub already is recognizing, and it could be duplicate service, or they could recognize if they so chose.
The city of Juneau, for instance, is in MPERS, and Mr. Runnagle indicated he had about 5 or 7 years or something like that with Juneau time.
5 years, yeah.
Could you buy in, on, have you ever inquired, or is it even maybe something possible, could you buy in that time if you wanted to?
No. I was told no because you can't, it was not continuous. When we went to statehood, apparently the employees of Juneau just correct me if I'm wrong, didn't they vote that they were not going to come into the system, and then sometime later they re-voted and decided they would. And that break in there disallowed me to go back because there was a break and they didn't come into the system. Had they decided initially to come into the system, yes, I would be covered.
Is that interpretation correct?
It's hard for me to answer. It's really a Juneau rule, you see. I'm not sure. Each employer has some flexibility on how they handle their prior service. When the municipality of Anchorage recently joined our system, actually it was a city at the time, they recognized their prior service under certain conditions. They said if you were already employee on board when they joined, fine. Otherwise, they must return and work for 3 years, very similar to this feature, before they would recognize prior service with the city. Other entities have done the same. I can't say whether or not the city of Juneau says if you weren't on board at the time they joined, if you returned to work for them for 3 years, they would recognize. I know they did recognize prior service for those individuals who were working at the time. Now, what rules they've established for reemployment people, I just don't know. It could be checked, but I... Somebody called me on this issue the other day, and I had to refer them to the city. I don't know whether it was it you, by any chance.
Oh,
yeah.
I looked into this a couple years ago.
But it's entirely up to the entity. We have no concern because it's their past service liability. They're going to pay for it. If they recognize it, if it's recognized this way, the state's going to pick up their liabilities for them. And perhaps even duplicate it if they have a separate system, such as the city of Anchorage.
Well, my feeling on it anyway is to stick in some sort of a provision to eliminate duplicate credit. As far as the money goes, send it to finance. Would it be possible to come up with some language to eliminate claiming credit, you know, under two separate systems?
I'm just trying to think how it could be done, and you know. The problem with trying to come up with language is that you may be able to effectively do it, but by depending on the language you put in, you may also discourage an employer from recognizing his own past service liability and shifting it over on the state. And that's the, let's take, for example, an entity that does not now belong to RPERS, of which there are a few. Coming in, they have that option, what they want to do. The city of Ketchikan, the Kenai Borough, are the two last remaining large entities who aren't in our system. With the knowledge that the state is doing this and picking up their past service liability, then they're certainly not even going to address the issue. They're going to say, heck, the state will take care of it for us. Let them pick up the cost. We'll only recognize back to, say, statehood, rather than perhaps somebody that has worked for them prior to that time. And that's the hard thing of about putting restrictive language in, is to try and do the right job that I think you're trying to get at. And it's bad if you have to start naming municipalities. I mean, it's already bad enough naming occupations in the law, let alone by municipality. It'll be just come a real problem. I'll be happy to work with Dick and see what we can come up with, but at this point I can't just give you a clause or something that's going to be all things for all people.
I think you work with Bill, two of you work with Bill, and he's going to be kind of an expert on retirement programs.
He wants to do it now.
Yeah.
Then why don't we try to put together a substitute? We'll see what we get back.
That was the intent was not to cover any of the services. The question of duplicate service.
Well, the intent was not to cover
any. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Maybe there is a real danger there. I certainly can't imagine anybody working for a city for 20 years and wanted to go work for the state.
Well, the point I'm raising there may not be in a peace officer or fireman capacity. There's no restriction. Let's, with a 20-year and out provision, there's a lot of firemen, policemen in Anchorage with, say, 15, 18 years of service in their 40s. And, or maybe more even. In their 45, it would be very easy. They could come in at most any occupation under with the state and work the minimum 3 years and then have any service prior to 61, really, the establishment of this system, recognized. So if somebody was employed with, a good example might be someone that was employed in the early 60s in Anchorage, or in the early 50s or mid 50s in Anchorage, could still be a relatively young person. And there may be an incentive for them to leave as soon as they can there, come to work for the state, because they're going to have the 5 or 6 or 8 years they served before 61 picked up after working just 3 years here, where, you know, it's they're getting 2 or 3 to 1 service out of their short-term employment. That's the thing. And I could hardly blame them. You know, it'd be a great opportunity. Because there were no contributions during that period of time. So it's free service. When we give service under this, we're talking about free, because it's all prior to the establishment of the retirement system.
One mistake I think the original drafters made, should have been bought in.
Well, you see, originally...
Do anything about it now.
Originally, it was intended strictly for territorial service, and when the federal employment crept in is where the problem is, and we've repeatedly testified that on existing law, there's a lot of people in there that are getting benefits under the federal system and also under our system as a result of the, when this was first passed. And that was our concern... Well, it has been for many, many years, and certainly since I've been involved, we were quite concerned. We found a case where a person had a vested right in the federal system, and we're also paying 23 years of the same service in our system, amounted to another $1,300 a month out of our system on top of the service they're getting out of the federal. We have to offset the federal, but the federal's benefits are so much lower than ours that we're really picking up a liability of the federal government, you might say. And they're delighted to have us do it. In fact, they've just recently announced that in the case of the National Guard technicians, there's been a big flap over that for a number of years, and they finally come out with an announcement. Any state who recognizes National Guard technician service, which was former federal service, the feds will not recognize. They're letting the state pick up the whole thing, and they're just backing off. And the state is, in effect, by doing some of these things, I'm not saying in this instance, but when it gets involved with federal, they're just saying, fine, if you're going to recognize it, we won't pay anything. And that certainly wasn't the intent of a lot of the legislation that's gone on. But, I mean, they're very quick to step away from their liabilities if they can see them being taken care of under a local system. And I think we've got a similar thing here. The political subs will be very quick to allow the state to pick up their appropriate share of the past service liability if this type of legislation is enacted.
Well, we'll see what we come up with for a proposed substitute. And take it up again whenever it's drafted.
Well, did you have a chance yet to get fiscal notes on that concept you were talking about the other day?
Yes, sir. I got it this morning.
Oh, great.
0.05 of 180 million, I think it works out to about $95,000.
Was that all? Yeah, that's a lot of money.
I'm glad you said it, not me.
Yeah, we toss around the millions here. $95,000. Well, we got a situation. Bob can correct me if I state it wrong, because I always have to think it through at least twice before I say it. We got a situation, whereas if you work for the state right now and you retire, your benefits will be computed on the 2% point, 2% times the 2% of your, you know, best 3 years times the number of years and that sort of thing. Okay, and if you retired some time ago, I guess this isn't 100% true, but virtually it's true. If you're on retirement, having quit some time ago, you're paid 2% of whatever your three-year formula was. But if you quit some time ago and weren't ready for retirement yet, I mean, you got your vested time in, so you got in 10 years or 12 years, whatever it might be, but you're now working for somebody else, and when you get to be retirement age, you will retire. Unfortunately, on that deal, the way the law is written, instead of getting the 2%, you get whatever was the appropriate percent at the time you retired. It might be, say, 1.5%. It might even be as low as 1%, but chances are it's probably 1.5%. So you got kind of this funny sandwich situation where you got 2% of that's already on retirement, 2% of these guys up here that are going to retire later that are working for the state now. But the poor guy that happens to have worked for the state just isn't working for him right at this moment, he's just going to get 1.5% or whatever. And so, but with the deletion of about 6 words here, mean, the words as it is in effect on the date of his termination of employment, we can correct that and make it uniform that everybody will get, you know, when their retirement finally comes around, whether they're on a deferred retirement or just a straight retirement, it'll be based on a 2% factor and not on 1.5 or 1% or whatever it was. Did I state that approximately correct?
Except for the very last thing, that's right. I think it's not the 2%, it's whatever is in effect at the time.
Oh, yeah, but if we raise it later, yeah.
If you went somewhere down the road to a 2.5% formula, and I mentioned to you before, the logic for that is while the person's working, either the employer and the employee are combined making contributions on a given set of benefits. And if subsequent changes occur, of course, there's adjustments in the employer's rate or the employee's. And that was the reason initially, saying that if you're not around making those contributions, or if the employer isn't behind making them towards your retirement, then the only real thing that's funded for you is a certain benefit level, and that being that's in effect at the time. So what this in effect does is remove that and says no matter what happens in the future, this essentially goes all into an unfunded liability situation at such time as a person, well, it immediately goes into an unfunded liability, but it becomes more apparent at the time a person applies. The actuary is saying when he worked it was 1.5, but when we start paying benefits it's a 2. And by going on this, we're recognizing that this will happen. And of course, all we know really what we've had in the past to the present. We don't know what's going to happen in the future. And the removal of this, you're correct in saying that these are the costs, the annual costs that it's going to take to make up for those that we know about now. It will have a tendency to make future retirement changes more expensive because of it, because you're recognizing an increase for those that aren't currently working but nevertheless ultimately have a vested right out of the system. I think that's quite obvious. If extreme example, we went to a 3% formula, everybody who's no longer working with a vested right, we are in fact giving them a 3% even though there's never been any contributions recognizing that type of thing. So that's the main effect it will have.
Yeah, of course, if we did say go to a 3%, somebody that's working this month and quit next month, even though he's never contributed on the basis of 3%, he would still gain it.
That's true.
And
or like you say, a person can return for a very brief duration and qualify and establish himself as a current employee and terminate. So I guess like any retirement law and others, it's impossible to close all the loopholes. It's just normally that doesn't occur. A person has, you know, they reach the age and they make application, but we've seen it happen both ways.
I'm not really arguing with you either, but I would just kind of guess that, for instance, if we went to, say, 2.5%, when we went from 1.5 to 2, we apparently brought along all the people that were retired in the past anyway to bring them up to snuff. And I would just guess that if we went to 2.5, we would probably, again, bring along all the people that retired in the past.
Right. Now, that's a little different story, because we did, in fact, do that. All this is suggesting when they're first appointed to retirement, it will be on the basis of the benefit earned or the benefit level in existence when they terminate. Then, as you say, when we went from 1.5, 1.75 to 2 to a flat 2, there was a provision made that anyone then drawing retirement would get a 2, and in that piece of legislation you were then recognizing the cost of doing that, and we recalculated everybody up to a 2% formula at that time. The difference when this is out, then that wouldn't be really necessary any longer to go back, because it would automatically apply to anyone who was on a deferred basis. So it does eliminate an opportunity for the legislature to look at the costs of it when it's like that, because there's nothing further that has to be done.
I'd like to suggest that we put this out as a committee bill.
Okay.
With the signature, that's fine. And then this would go straight to finance then.
You have to get a fiscal number.
Well, yeah, he said you got 95,000.
You said there is a fiscal note,
right? No, there's a number.
A number.
There will be a fiscal
number.
There will be a fiscal note early next week, but that's that's basically the fiscal note plus a few bucks for some administrative costs, because we'll have to go in and do some changes with our work. But I mean, that's maybe 1,500, 2,000 bucks. We're not talking about.
You got 95 grand of small changes. Mike does 1,500.
Well, that's why I figure I could get my two if his 95 was small.
Anything under 500,000. Just make
it's
even happen.
Okay. Capital Planning Commission bill.
Oh, we finally got.
Okay, well, we have the Capital Planning Commission.
Wait,
bill.
No rec.
No rec.
Were you coming in?
Okay, we'll introduce that as a committee bill, and did you say put a committee report in?
Yeah, let's put a committee report with it. And
okay.
Oh, boy. Are you a co-sponsor on this?
Yeah.
On this kind of thing?
What's wrong?
Oh, nothing. I didn't get on it because.
Well, we substituted the site selection committee's bill.
I know it. I just.
You know, what's incredible is that doesn't have a finance referral.
Doesn't?
No.
No, it's judiciary.
Judiciary, I think. I have no objection to going to judiciary, but boy, it seems to me like it'll be a finance too. We're creating some real zingers in there, including $50,000 just for the possibility.
Well,
$50,000,
nothing to it.
Well, we haven't actually
moved the cap. That's $50,000 is big. Deal.
Well, the their appropriation that they've submitted covers that, although I imagine if they'd have to go in for a supplemental if they wanted to do the competition.
That goes in the Department of Natural Resources. Do we agree to that?
What?
I'm reading the original.
No, you're reading the original. Puts it, it has an independent existence with administrative support. Don't want to be accused of delaying the capital move.
Words.
Okay, thank
you. Is that
it? Where did you try to figure out?